I'd like to call this Eastern Highlands Health District Board of Directors meeting to order. Appreciate people joining us in person and online. Millie, you have the attendance? All right, so
Are we recording?
We are recording.
Okay, are recording. So with that, the first order of business is actually a public hearing on proposed sanitary code section 5, barbershop, hairdressing, cosmetology, and nail salons. Rob, do you want to do a quick background before we open up for public comment?
Absolutely. For just by way of background, the health district initiated a process to adopt and amend our sanitary code about 3 years ago, leading up to the beginning of 2020. We engaged an attorney. I had proposed language written, engaged the business community at that time about the proposed language, and received some feedback, incorporated that feedback into the proposed language at that time. And this is all in response to a mandate that our agency is under to do annual inspections of cosmetology establishments, which we have not been doing. And so this is the agency's effort to come into compliance with that statewide mandate to do those annual inspections. And this language in this sanitary code or these amendments will provide the framework for permitting inspections and inspection standards for cosmetology businesses. With that kind of general overview, I'm also going to read the public hearing notice into the record, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman. Public hearing notice, proposed Eastern Highlands Health District Sanitary Code, Section 5, Barbershop, Hairdressing, Cosmetology, Nail Salon, and Spa. The Eastern Highlands Health District Board of Directors will hold the following public hearing on June 16th, 2022 at 4:30 p.m. at the Coventry Town Hall Annex, 1712 Main Street, Coventry, Connecticut, to receive the public's comments regarding the proposed amendments to the Eastern Highlands Health District Sanitary Code, Section 5, Barbershop, Hairdressing, Cosmetology, Nail Salon, and Spa. At this hearing, interested persons may appear and be heard and written communications received. In accordance with Public Act 22-3, this will be a hybrid meeting. Video recording of the meeting will be available at ehhd.org within 7 days after the meeting. Public comments will be accepted by mail at mbrasso@ehhd.org or by U.S. Post Office mail at 4 South Eagleville Road, Mansfield, Connecticut, 06268. Must be received prior to the meeting. Please email mbrasso@ehhd.org or call 860-429-3325 by 3 p.m. on the day of the meeting to receive instructions on how to view, listen, or comment live. The Eastern Highlands Health District proposed sanitary code section 5 documents can be accessed at ehhd.org or by requesting the documents by emailing mbrasso@ehhd.org. No information from the public shall be received after the close of the public hearing dated Mansfield, Connecticut, this first day of June 2022. Robert L. Miller, Director of Health, and I think we should pass a motion to open the public hearing.
Sure. So we'll open the public hearing, and you did have an information meeting on May 3rd?
Yes, we did.
So we'll formally open the public hearing. This is an opportunity for the public to give feedback on this proposed ordinance. You're welcome to sit where you are or speak at the podium.
John Stewart.
Could you introduce
yourself?
Check
the Facebook, please, sir.
All right, somebody is not muted. Ryan, I think you're not muted. Thank you.
Helps me when I find something to justify treating the man as everything
you want to do. You can mute him.
This is what I'm telling myself. So, I think that we're looking at the moment to display that he has a real love.
Oh, mute.
So,
Ryan, you're not muted.
We just muted him.
He is now.
Millie, why don't you read who else is on the meeting so they're all
so they all know.
Okay, so virtually we have Tammy Nuccio from Tolland, Susan Powers from Scotland, Ryan Islesworth from Mansfield. In the room we have Eric Anderson from Andover, Rob Miller, Director of Health, John Elsesser, from Coventry, Erica Wasensky from Willington, and Deb Walsh from Coventry.
So, you want to go first?
Sure. My name is Kim Robinson. I am owner of Headliner Salon and Spa in Tarrant, Connecticut. And I know I've been at all the meetings, so I'm just curious as to if any headway was made with a couple of my concerns that I brought forth before were the idea of having to spray things like your mirror and chairs and things and having things sit with hospital-grade disinfectant for 10 full minutes. Having been in a lot of doctor's offices in the last 6 months or so with my mother and myself, I haven't had one doctor's office that sprays things down and has a 10-minute turnaround time. So it seems extreme for what we do. So I had asked about potentially using higher-end hospital-grade disinfectants that have a 1 minute to 3 minute on-surface disinfection time, like Cabicide and things like that. And then my other question was about a concern about having to install utility sinks in every service area if you're already a establishment that's been in business and you don't own your building. So I rent a large space, and trying to replumb that space to put utility sinks in certain treatment rooms would mean not only shutting my own business down, but the businesses down below me because of where they'd have to access plumbing and all, and it'd be incredibly costly for businesses that are just pulling themselves out of COVID. So those were my two big concerns, and I just wanted to know where we stood on that.
Did you want me to engage? Or?
Why don't we have other comments and then let people comment first, and then you can respond.
Okay.
Anyone else want to speak today? You're more than welcome. That's why we're here.
I agree with everything that she's saying. That's another concern of mine. I've been going to restaurants. Me and my husband go out every single evening. I have not seen them wipe down anything, door handles or anything, you know, or tables. You know, they kind of clean them up really quick. I know.
Just for the record, can I have your name?
Oh, certainly. Julie Cousin from Tallent, Connecticut.
Thank you.
And then the hand sinks. I am just a small home salon. So you go up my stairs. Here's my room where I cut hair, and my bathroom's right there with the sink. Do I need a sink outside of my bathroom door, which would be, we'd all be in 3 feet of each other. I don't, I was, you know, concerned of the plumbing and also of that too. So both the 10-minute turnaround, I could actually do that. That's fine. But is everybody doing that? Because I don't think so. In restaurants, I would really think that they should. But I guess, you know, that's just my opinion. It just, I sit at some tables, I'm like, oh. But so we spray everything down and leave it for 10 minutes to dry before the next person can come in. And is there something faster than that?
So. Do you want to comment, or are you just...
Oh, no, I'm just listening.
Okay. Any other follow-up comments that you have?
I think one of the biggest concerns truly is this 10-minute turnaround time. And just, I guess my curiosity is where that even... is stemming from, like, what diseases have been transmitted by having a mirror not sprayed down by disinfectant, or like the people that come in to sit in my chair are, I cut hair, so they're fully dressed, and I don't, it makes no sense if I don't have to spray down the waiting room chairs where the client just came in off the street and sat there and put their hands on my waiting room chair. I don't have to run out and spray that for 10 minutes, but the chair that they sat in while I cut their hair, wearing a clean cape that covers the chair, has to be sprayed for 10 minutes. There's no logic involved in this. It just seems like it's kind of a strange request, to be honest with you, and an extremely costly one, because if we add 10 minutes onto every single appointment, realistically it's going to be 15 minutes because we book on the 15th. So we're literally cutting our business by 25%. And that's a really, really big ask post-COVID when we've been struggling to get back to normal. It's just a really big ask. And we run an extremely clean salon, so it's not like I'm not looking to like run a dump here. We run very clean business. That just seems like it's not based in logic.
Thank you. Rob, did you want to respond at this point?
Yeah. Sure. So there's this provision there's an existing provision within the language of the proposed amendments, which provides for alternative disinfectants, which can have shorter contact times. It's just a matter of, in fact, the language just simply says the alternatives can be used. You just need to follow the instructions on the label to accommodate contact time for some of those other disinfectants. So the 10 minute originated from a work group, which included both local public health, the State Department of Public Health, and industry experts, your colleagues, as part of a work group which developed these guidelines some 10 years ago or so. And at that time, I believe it was ruled that 10 minutes was linked to a specific type of disinfectant, which was common in the industry, and so that's why the 10 minutes is there. But I think the fact that our language does have a workaround in there. For you to allow to use an alternative.
Okay, I didn't see that in here. So.
Yep, well, I can point it out.
That's fine. I'm glad to hear that there is.
Yep.
Point it out to all of us.
Excuse me?
Point it out to us.
Sure. Let's see.
Or according to the manufacturer's instructions.
Yep, that's it.
Which pages?
Page 33, section 5.8.7c, the spout base must be disinfected with an EPA registered disinfectant labeled as bacteriological fungicidal or vericidal
for at least 10 minutes or according to manufacturer's instructions.
Is that just a spa basin or is that also because page 32 under where it says note, it says that also counters, chairs, mirrors, sinks need to be disinfected after use. Once again, this item needs to be visibly wet and sprayed and wiped for 10 minutes, then wiped with a clean cloth. A 10-minute contact time is vital for proper infection control.
Right. So above note, under 8.5.8.3, under subsection 2, substance such implements shall be soaked for 10 minutes per manufacturer's suggested contact time, removed, rinsed, air-dried, and stored in a dryer or covered container, or per manufacturer's suggested contact time.
Okay, great.
So that covers it.
Fantastic. I love it. I'm so excited right now. I can tell you.
Yeah. So whatever legitimate EPA authorized disinfectant, disinfectant you can purchase commercially, follow their instructions for contact time, and that will be in compliance with the provisions of this regulation.
Excellent. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Okay. Now, regarding the hand seeks, if I may. So, first and foremost, our agency understands that these are new standards for existing businesses that have been around in some cases, many, many years. I would note, again, that those standards here, again, part of a work group, which, again, included local public health, state public health, and industry, your industry colleagues at the time. And they called for hand-washing stations near, in close proximity to your service areas for because hand-washing is one of the most essential functions that you can engage in to assure and mitigate the risk of disease transmission between yourselves and your customers. Now, as far as the proximity, that's open to discussion. Okay, that's, the health district has, can exercise its discretion on what we think an appropriate proximity is to a work service area. So if you've got a bathroom that's close to your work area, that's accessible to your customers, and there's a hand sink in there, then they can use that.
Okay.
That's a suitable alternative. If you've got a number of service areas, say you've got lots of work, you've got lots of chairs, and a single open room, we're not going to require a hand sink for every single chair. We will come with some kind of appropriate accommodation so that you can have a suitable number of hand sinks to service a suitable number of chairs. So if you've got two chairs, one hand sink, I'm sure would be fine. The bottom line is this: we're not in the business of putting undue hardship on small businesses in the community. I can assure you that we will be working with the small businesses, particularly as pertains to new regulations, which potentially impose capital costs. And so with that understanding, there may be some capital costs that we think are appropriate and necessary to reduce the risk of disease transmission. But with that said, we'll also work with whatever timeline that you think is appropriate. This is not, if we do decide based on our inspection that some improvements are necessary, we're also, in addition to coming up with reasonable improvements, we're also going to come up with a reasonable timeline.
Okay.
So just for everyone's knowledge, obviously this is a public hearing, so there'll be a record of this that will go into, you know, last. So that what's said here today and the responses are part of the permanent record, so that our health director is not here sometime in the future and somebody has a different opinion, there's a record of this public hearing.
So, exactly.
Any other discussion for the public hearing before ultimately the board, both remotely and here, we'll be discussing this and possibly taking action on it later in the agenda, so you're certainly welcome to stay and hear that discussion and dialogue, and we're thank you for the points that helped educate us. The response is very valuable to us. So unless anyone has some final words for the public hearing, we can close the public hearing and go on to the agenda. And I don't know whether we want to move that item up, but we can have that.
It's after public comments in the minutes. It's up to you.
Those will go fast, so I guess we'll stay with the agenda order. So we're going to just do the minutes of the meeting and opportunity for public comments, and then we'll get into discussion on this item. So you're certainly welcome to stay. So with that, I will deem the public hearing closed, and we will move on to the regular agenda. Which is, we already kind of called the meeting to order. So we'll do approval of minutes of April 21, 2022. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved by Deb Walsh and seconded by Eric. Discussions for possible changes. Hearing none, I guess we thank Millie for a brilliant job. all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Remotely, did everyone approve?
Aye.
Aye.
It sounds like a unanimous opinion, so I'll deem the minutes are approved. The next order of business is actually public comments. People are welcome. We open it up to the public to speak on this issue or any other issue that you wish to speak out before the board. Hearing no public comments, we'll move on to old business. Item one, proposed Eastern Highlands Health District Sanitary Code, Section 5, barbershops, hairdressing, hospitality, nail salons.
Sure, so you have in your packet copies of the public hearing notices, both went to the JI and into the Chronicle. We also sent direct emails to all the business owners, or snail mail, depending on whether we had email or not for them, ahead of this public hearing to make sure that we can get the message out as far or wide as possible. Within the packet is the original cover memo to the proposed language, which provided a program implementation timeline, the proposed language itself. And then also there's a PowerPoint in there in which we invited the business community to and presented it on May 3rd. And then finally on the cover memo, there is a recommended motion for consideration if the board concurs with moving this item forward for consideration.
So I think it's appropriate for discussion purposes to get that motion on the table, on the floor, I mean.
I move to adopt the proposed amendments to the Eastern Highlands Health District Sanitary Code, Section 5, Barbershop, Hairdressing, Cosmetology, Nail Salon, and Spa, as presented on June 16, 2022, effective July 1, 2022.
I'll second that.
So it's been moved by Erica and seconded by Deb Walsh, and we can start discussion.
Mm-hmm. Got a couple of questions, Ryan. Mm-hmm. First of all, you said that this discussion, this work study group that put this together, was 10 years ago.
Yes, that's the Connecticut statute, which has mandated annual inspections, has been around for like 15 years. Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering.
Four or five years into it, local public health realized that they needed some help with standards for mm-hmm. inspection standards. So State Health Department convened a work group to develop guidance. And this guidance and these guidance standards are actually on the State Health Department website. Mm-hmm. And that's what our sanitary code amendments are modeled after.
Yeah, but it seems to me that that issue that was raised today, and I was just rereading all this, I just found it to be not clear. I don't think that there was anything that was clear to anybody who's reading, including me, but particularly all of you, that we could use a newer, more effective disinfectant that probably is being used everywhere now that wasn't even thought about 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So maybe we should be a little more clear about some of these issues that are concerning people. And I don't know who would rewrite that to make it more clear, but as long as we promise to do so.
Well, I think, the other piece of this is that, as code enforcers, these are regulations in effect, mm-hmm. and you can make regulations clear, but the simpler the language, the potential more open it is to interpretation. Mm-hmm. That's why you kind of drill down on this, and that's where it unfortunately gets a little more complicated and harder to understand.
But do you think that's clear?
Or instructions as provided by manufacturer. I do. And I can tell you that our staff will be trained on this is how we'd be interpreting and applying that particular provision in the regulation.
I don't know. I would love to see. See that as necessary for manufacturers' directors, but it's not clear to me that allows for anything less than 10 minutes.
Or there's an or.
There's an or then.
Yeah. So it says or.
Okay. Well, as long as your staff is trying to understand it, I certainly didn't.
Yeah.
I think there might be an opportunity, right? Once this is put into use, to gain feedback from end users, and then to then determine whether or not we need to make adjustments based on that.
Yeah.
So
that's
just
good
because
idea.
We put something in place doesn't mean.
It
there isn't an opportunity to be
yeah.
amended.
No, it's a good idea.
Well, not just end users, but also the people that are doing the actual enforcement. Because if you find out 6 months from now, the same question gets raised each time, the same concern, we probably should adjust that.
We have the freedom to do that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We could engage, we could, implement the program and run it for one, or for 12 or 24 months, whatever this group deems appropriate, and then reconsider further amendments at that time.
So to do that, just process-wise, we would need another, call another public hearing and have to then, you know, take another vote. Mm-hmm. So there is a process that we would go through which brings helpful information forward. You know, that's certainly something that is wise for us to always do, is to always keep the door open. Secondly, and we'll go to the room of people to comment in just a second, but if we choose to adopt this, we will be sending copies of this out to people, and the cover letter on it can also specifically mention that, you know, these issues came up, and specifically, you know, manufacturer's instructions will be a guiding, because that's what they're licensed for. So I think we can put that right in the cover letter with the regulations, and also talk about
hand sinks,
and you know that this is new to all of us. We're going to be, you know, trying to work with you
yep.
to the degree that, you know, we still enforce the public health code and do our jobs. But
yeah, that's what we're here for. So come back. Mm-hmm.
Anyone remotely have other things to talk about on this proposed
yes.
motion?
Yes. Tammy Nuccio, I do have a couple of questions. I kind of agree with Millie. I'm looking at this and reading it, and I think we could be more clear in the fact that an alternative substance can be used that has a quicker drying time. If we're clear with that, and if we're going to do a trial run, I'd like to make sure that the businesses aren't overly penalized during that trial run, and we're taking the feedback rather than just penalizing them for that. I do have a little bit of the same concern as the people who spoke. You know, I know Headliners well. I know a bunch of other salons and that, and you know, hairdressers are washing your hair and all that. They're constantly, their hands are always being washed, so it seems a little punitive to say that they have to have hand sinks everywhere. And a lot of these people do rent their buildings, so I absolutely hear that concern, and would like to know what, I don't like the idea of it leaving up to us case by case to kind of come up with this place we're gonna let do this and this place we're gonna let do that. I think if we're gonna do a trial run, it needs to be with the intent of gathering the data and making the regulation better, definitely quicker than this is 10 years old. The cleaning technologies are totally different now. And I just want to make sure that the businesses aren't penalized, especially hairdressers, barbershops, and all that. The nail salons, they're the last to be able to be opened in some cases. So that's my feedback on this. I have some of the same concerns as the people who spoke and as Millie, and thinking that we can make this easier and not, and be a little more realistic on what we're asking the hairdressers to do compared to what we're asking other industries to do that are in close contact also.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak that's logging in?
No comments from me.
Reasonable timeline would be, is it a year, is it 18 months for us to revisit and kind of get a full report, you know, when those inspections would be done and you'd have a full scope?
Yeah, so I think it's reasonable. It would really, see, we got a transition period.
Right.
The proposed timeline is a transition period for the first 6 months, kind of an initial starting, presumably the tentative timeline is starting July 1st through December 31st. Working with the businesses to get their applications in and do that initial inspection. And then so the first application and fee would be good essentially for 18 months, up to 18 months, with the next renewal in January 2024. So it seems reasonable that next renewal could also, it may be appropriate that can be the end date of kind of a reevaluation of the program, and maybe solicit additional feedback
with maybe, you know, an update in that 6 months,
yeah,
you know, after you've gotten that initial period, with an update to us on what you found from that once you were implementing
this
plan.
Yeah, I think after 12 months and 6 months before the next renewal period.
Yeah, I would say a report to us, back to us after the 6 month implementation, and any proposed changes should be done at least 3 months before the next renewal. So 15 months, because we have to go through the public hearing and so forth. So,
right.
So, if that makes sense to the body of, you know, I think we want to stay engaged on this issue because it's a change, that we get a report back after the first initial period transition to see what issues come up, because we may, at the end of that, decide we have to, like, look at changing things faster.
I was just going to say, John, what would the process be if they wanted to dispute it? If they think that it's overly punitive or that they don't have capability to put hand sinks in to the quantity that the health district wants, how can we make sure that we're not going to be penalizing these small businesses for a year plus however long it takes us to review it and get back?
Well, I mean, it's code, so there's due process since it's law. And so any time
goes to state.
So well, an appeal can come. An appeal can come to. Well, let's see.
It was in here. So
yeah.
Yep.
So bear with me here a second. I'll look it up.
Suspension. Page 30. Some of the reason I think that 6 month time frame will give us some indications. You will have then been able to ideally get applications from all.
Okay.
I agree with Erica. I think 6 months, but you know, it's a year could be.
So in the general language of our. Of our sanitary code. First of all, it's always appealable. Any action of the local health director is always appealable to the Commissioner of Public Health.
So that's 5.6.6. Any appeal, written order is provided by Connecticut General Statutes 19A229, which would be the director, state director of health, right?
We're 5.6. We're
5.6.
Page 31.
Page 31.
Yep.
And similar language on 5.7.
That's right. So it's appealable to the State Department of Public Health.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
The implementation period, next 6 months of implementation, right? Are we going to be able to get to everyone who is? That's the goal.
We should. Our plan is to get, and there's about 50 establishments.
Okay.
So our plan is to inspect every single one before the end of December.
Okay.
So we should have a very good, clear picture after 6 months of what kind of trials and tribulations, if any.
Right,
so why don't you report back in 6 or 7 months and let's just understand what issues, you know, if we adopt this, what issues have been raised, and we can make a decision then whether we want to do something immediately or we want to wait through one full renewal cycle before we do anything.
Makes sense, does. And well,
Dr. Dart just had a note on it and disappeared.
Did we see it?
Dr. Dart, we missed your comment. Millie, could you maybe bring it up? He had a chat.
He had a chat box, okay.
Can you see it?
Yeah. Okay.
How does it compare to other jurisdictions?
So in restaurants, restaurants are required to have a hand sink.
I mean for other cosmetic or esthetic.
Oh, for other jurisdictions. This is based on the statewide guidance.
Okay.
that's published.
So it's no different. It's no more nor less.
That's correct.
Restricting.
That, well, I mean, local jurisdictions can modify the guidance and codify.
Well, that's what I want to know. Are there others that are less restrictive than this?
I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, it seems to me that if this is the way everyone else is doing it, it doesn't seem that we want to be any less strict than this.
Well,
even though it may pose a burden for the operator, that this is the same standard that they would have to adhere to in any jurisdiction in which they operate.
Well, I think they all require hand sinks. I'd be surprised if they don't. As you know, hand washing is an extremely important function.
Right.
And so the only question is proximity and number of hand sinks. And we have some discretion there. As I said earlier, we're gonna do our best to work with the business owners and not be punitive, as was reasonably stated before. And I think we can certainly get a clear picture as to where we stand on that particular point, you know, after an appropriate evaluation period.
Rob, can I comment?
Yes, well, it's up to John.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
John, sorry. My understanding is the main focus of a hand sink in restaurants is that most sinks are full of pots and pans and everything, but in a beauty parlor, as Tammy's mentioned, you know, every chair has a sink, and it's designed for washing people's hair and their heads, and they're not full of anything. So to have another hand sink next to your sink where you wash people's hair seems to be ridiculous.
So, yeah.
It's just my thought.
Yeah, so kitchens, the food service industry, there are some kind of similarities in the type of plumbing that they have, in that it's the hand sink, hand washing is so important and so essential to appropriately mitigate risk of disease transmission, the sink needs to be dedicated to hand washing. And that's how the food service industry works. All their hand sinks are just used for hands. There shouldn't be any pots or pans or food. If there is, they get dinged on the inspection. So that's just how important hand washing is.
My point is, in the food industry, those things are always full of pots and pans. That's the point of a hand sink. It's so small, you can't use it for anything but wash your hands. But if every chair has a sink behind them that has nothing in it but a sprayer, I would just think you could wash your hands and be perfectly sanitary in your head sink.
Well,
I'm not a beautician, so I don't know.
Yeah, so I mean.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go with what Mark was saying. Like, you get your hair washed, they're washing your hair with shampoo and soap as they're doing your hair. So it seems redundant. And same thing when you go get a pedicure or manicure, your feet are in water, they're rubbing your feet with soap and water. So I don't think anybody's disputing the fact that hand washing is important, but I think if anything, hairdressers and nail sessions, and that they're washing their hands more times a day than the average person.
Well, I mean, I can go on and make arguments for the reason for having dedicated hand washing sinks. I mean, if you've got a dedicated hand washing sink, I think there's a certain prompting to the fact that you got a dedicated sink, so they're more likely to wash their hands if they're prompted by a dedicated sink. Also, if you got a sink that's being used for head and hair washing, I understand that it's a different part of the body. There could be different contaminants associated with the different part of the body. And also, quite frankly, this is the industry standard. I mean, the individuals in this room and other professionals in the industry understand that usually there is a hand washing sink. dedicated and not only dedicated just for hand washing. And it's unusual for it to be for a head sink to be also used for a hand washing sink.
So, if I could just add one more thought, though, the idea that we need so many additional hand washing sinks, mm-hmm. when the hand washing time is going to be fairly fast compared to the customers that are, might be using it or the staff that might be using it. So, and I understand there's flexibility of not having one at each station.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm almost saying it's almost like we ought to be reasonable to think about only having one dedicated hand sink in each.
For each chair, we're not.
That's no, for each facility, yeah. One for the whole thing. Because if we wait for things in life, and if you have to wait 30 seconds to 45 seconds to a minute and a half for somebody to clear the hand washing sink so you can go, but just the flow of the business, it's not going to be that you're going to have lines queuing up.
So that's another important point to Tammy's question. Somebody could have their head in a sink, and then something happens. The hand gets contaminated, and the operator, the hairdresser understands. Suddenly, my hand's contaminated. Like maybe they for whatever reason, you know, maybe they put their hand to their mouth or something. They realize, oh, I should have done that. I need to wash my hands now. But there's a head in the sink, so I can't do that. So I mean, that's while that scenario is low probability. But other similar like scenarios in which there's a head in the sink when out of time when you really probably should wash your hands, you know, could lead somebody not to wash their hands in a circumstance in which they really should.
Is there some confusion about the ratio of people to hand sinks? I mean, I'm looking at the language, it doesn't seem, I get the sense that one of the concerns is the businesses would have to provide so many hand sinks, but if it's, say, a small salon that can accommodate, like, what, 20 people or something like that?
That's a big salon.
In reality, when I've been to nail salons, there is a sink that you get directed to go and wash your hands, and there's not a set of sinks everywhere. Just there's one out.
I don't think there's any specific... I'll have to look in here. But
I think it said per service area. So, yeah. For example, if you had... It mentioned specifically estheticians, nail technicians, and hair.
Yep.
It did not mention massage, but I think massage is a different industry, sort of. But I believe it was each service area. So my interpretation of that was in the manicure area, there would need to be a sink. In the pedicure area, there would need to be a sink. In both skin rooms, there would need to be a sink. And on the hair salon floor somewhere, there would need to be a sink.
So it says,
that was my interpretation. I don't know
right.
if that's correct.
Hand sinks in an area where headdressers, cosmetologists, technicians, it goes on to list them, provide services are required. So in the area where the services are being provided, hand sinks are required. And so the language is relatively broad.
No, it just has an S on there.
Hand sinks. Yeah. So yeah. Well, I mean,
yeah, that just.
Yeah, so it's just so it's eight. It's 585 on page 33,
right.
And hand washing is required before and between providing service, and it goes on to soap must be required. So the language is broad, which means we can provide. The health district can exercise some discretion, which is the point I made before, mm-hmm. And we're not going to be punitive over this. The idea is to make sure that there's dedicated hand sink. That's in that's from relatively close proximity and accessible to these workers, so that if they feel they need or it's appropriate that they do, they can and should wash their hands. Mm-hmm. So if we start to get really prescriptive about it, you know, say, well, one sink for every two chairs, mm-hmm. or sink has to be within, you know, 5 feet of a chair. Then you know that eliminates and restricts our ability at the local level to exercise that discretion, mm-hmm. And we would really like to be able to do that so that it doesn't pose an undue burden onto the local business owners.
The other question I would have, Rob, and then
there's also 596 that says a separate utility stain shall be provided for the proper feeding of services and equipment. So is that a totally other, another special utility stain?
Yes, it is. And we can, and you know, utility sink, I mean, it really depends on what's going on in the business. Some of these businesses already have sinks that they use for utility purposes, and we can look at that.
So that could be like a mop sink?
It could, yeah, a mop sink.
So I think some of this language, to Rob's point, does allow them to have some discretion. He spoke to the, you know, the public comment about proximity. And so that's why, you know, I asked about that feedback time and that update to us, so we can get a sense of how many businesses have been potentially burdened and affected by needing more sinks. I see a place like Headliner is very different than a home based with one chair. And I think the question regarding Headliners is they have multiple rooms for different procedures. But in the language, I see it as an area. So it's whether or not the area is determined to be that room, or an area is determined to be maybe the spa side of your salon.
Right, right.
And what will go in. And this gives the health district the ability to work in that direction. Now, I would be concerned if suddenly in 6 months we hear, you know, 50, 75% of these businesses were affected and needed to add so many additional wash areas, then we might want to take a look at that and we might be seeing more appeals. But I think the proximity question is what it is, and you know, maybe we tweak that hand sinks to hand sinks with an S in parentheses.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because someone might need a hand sink and you might need multiple hand sinks.
Right.
And I think this language gives us the ability, a place to start. And I do see the need for a wash sink separate from where you wash your hair, because they don't, in your salon, every chair does not have its own sink. You go to a certain area.
Absolutely.
So having someplace else for someone to go. But I think that Rob has touched on, they're willing to have the discussion to attempt to mitigate some of those costs and time frames if something needed to be put in place.
Right.
Mr. Chair, to follow up on that, exactly what I was thinking about, most of these places rent, I would assume, maybe some of them own their buildings, but that's another point that was raised and I think is really telling, because if you have to order three hand sinks in a place that, even though they need them, that doesn't have the plumbing, and I can think of several places in this town that might have real problems with that, so... And I would say that, you know, this is another thing we have to be aware of, that these people don't necessarily own their property and they're not as free to make the kind of changes we would like. They may have to move, and that may cause a real hardship. So we have to just be cognizant of these kinds of things.
Absolutely. Other comments or questions?
Did we decide that it's going to be 6 months?
We decided that we need a report, and we'll decide after that report whether we need to take more immediate action or wait a little bit longer to see it. Because at the end of 6 months, we may not be through all the adjustments phase yet. We'll have to see where we are. But we do want a report, and may decide at the end of that six-month period whether we need to take action sooner. That's the sense I got from the feeling of the group right now, is that we'll wait at least 6 months. We may, based on that report, be able to wait further into the period, but at no point we would need to make adjustments that should happen before the 18-month period.
Yep.
Which means we have to back up for the hearing and changes.
Mm-hmm. That's how you understood to it.
Which would be in the fall of 2023.
Mm-hmm. So, any other comments or questions on this? So we have a motion.
Just thankful and appalled.
I don't think I've ever actually set foot in a salon, so I find myself a little bit of a disadvantage as to understanding.
And I'm not a good one to judge.
The only other comment is when we start talking about sinks and salons, and we're narrowing down to salons, nail
businesses that are strictly a nail salon. They don't have a hairdressing sink, right. So we can't, you know, assume that that's just going to be
all have bathrooms.
So, right, that's good. That's true. So, yeah, I think giving you the opportunity to implement what is here and then see what pitfalls we come across.
So, I think we're done with discussion, and we'll take a vote predicated on all the things that we've agreed upon, that there'll be a letter going out as part of this explaining the process and explaining that there's a certain flexibility, and that they should talk with the health department, and if need be, they can talk with us, that at the end of 6 months, we're going to take a look back to see how it's going, and see what type of changes are needed and when. So if I've captured that, I think we could take a vote, and all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposition or abstentions?
All those balls.
Hearing none, unless you haven't unmuted yourself. I'll declare that as unanimously approval, and thank you all for the public comment and the healthy discussion to get a better product going forward. So thank you, guys.
Thanks for the feedback.
Just remind folks that at any of our meetings, they can make public comment on anything, so they don't have to necessarily wait the 6 or 15 months.
Very good point. As you saw, we have a public comment meeting at the start of every public every meeting that we have, so you're welcome to come and tell us how things are going in the end.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we can move on.
Did you close the hearing?
No, we're closing the hearing. Yeah. So thank you all. We can move on to new business item two, proposed position classification change. Rob?
Sure. So unfortunately, our environmental health inspector incumbent resigned 2 weeks ago after 8 months of employment and some staff time investing in getting the person up to speed and qualified and certified. And this is indicative of our ongoing challenges to fill this position at the health district. The market for qualified environmental health field staff is extremely competitive right now, and has been this way for a couple of years now. And so what I'd like, what I'm asking for the board's consideration is to give me the authority to reclassify, essentially reclassify the position on the fly if I deem that there's a candidate that's appropriate, that's qualified. Right now, the position is classified as an environmental health inspector, but we've got two other environmental health professional classifications. We've got sanitarian one and sanitarian two. I would like to be able to essentially broaden the job posting to advertise for anybody within those three qualification classifications can apply for this single position, and then they would be based on the with the appropriate candidate, you know, they would obviously fall within one of those three classifications, and I would deem which classification is appropriate. Now, with that obviously comes if we get a candidate that meets either the class sanitarian one or the sanitarian two classification, then obviously that bumps them up into a higher pay range. Right now there's $44,285 in the budget for fiscal year 2022-23 for the environmental health inspector. That's the bottom of the environmental health inspector pay range, because that's where this individual was. There is some additional monies that that just recently became available in the budget as a result of the town of Mansfield notifying us that our insurance health premiums are going to be significantly less than what we budgeted, and the amount for fiscal year 22-23, and the amount of $34,350. It would certainly be appropriate at sometime in the near term for my office to engage the Finance Committee to consider proposed amendments, given that significant reduction in the health insurance premiums. But that said, I would like to at least use a portion, if not, depending on for the right candidate, perhaps all of that, those funds, for hiring purposes to fill this essential position. It's also important to note that there's still another check and balance on this particular hiring decision. Candidate that meets has the appropriate qualifications, if an offer is higher than the minimum of the particular pay range for that classification, then that requires personnel committee approval prior to authorizing that offer. So essentially, I am asking the board to allow me to reclassify the position as needed and appropriate in an effort to broaden the candidate pool and to give us a better opportunity and better odds of filling this position given the current labor market.
So, Rob, if we hire somebody at a higher level,
higher class,
could they then also be asked to do other duties as time would allow, like filling in for a person that's on vacation?
Well, we kind of do that anyway. I mean, all the environmental health field staff, we work as a team in the despite the fact that, you know, we've got some of them stationed at satellite offices in Tallinn and Coventry, and sometimes working in other offices. You know, management is always working to make sure that there's vacation coverage when vacation occurs, that other program areas are covered, whether it be land use septic or whether it be food service. All the sanitarian ones and sanitarian twos are cross-trained to be able to cover all of the environmental health service categories, you know, wells, septic, food complaints. An environmental health inspector is essentially an entry-level position. Their capacity to provide service in those other areas is significantly limited because they just don't have the experience. But to answer your question, John, sure, if we hired somebody at a higher level, they would absolutely have the capacity to cover and to provide service in other areas.
Other questions or discussion or comments?
Yeah, I have a quick question, John. I'm having trouble understanding why you have to come to the board to be allowed to do something in any administrative.
Because the budget is predicated on this position.
Yep.
Correct, but you know, by the fact that this person has resigned, and we have a, you know, probably not going to be hiring for a couple of months, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be an issue.
The issue is the budget is predicated on we have this position.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob is saying, I want to either have this position if I can find one,
or this one. I totally understand that. Yeah.
But that's not what our approved budget from the Board of Directors was. So he's asking for the flexibility.
That's correct.
It's nitpicking as far as I'm concerned. There,
and then it'll have to come back to us with adjustments in the budget.
Even if we have the money this year, it leads to a future budget.
Certainly does.
Right. That's my question is, are you proposing using the full $34,000 if the person who left was making $60,000, you want to have the ability to hire somebody at $90,000 and then
that's going to be
the impact of the budget going forward?
No, right now the current budget has $44,285. So technically the highest this position could get paid would be $78,635. If the full $34,350 were utilized. I'm not anticipating that, but technically it is possible.
This labor market is
crazy.
We have to just with it.
And that will have an impact on the budget next year, because if you hire somebody at 77 rather than 44, it's a $30,000 differential plus increase from this point on.
For the salary line item, that's correct. But overall budget, it's, you know, the
depends what health insurance does next year.
Yeah, that's true. It depends on what health insurance does.
Yeah, that implies that insurance is going to stay that low next year to be able to compensate for those increases.
Yeah,
this was the
we would agree that's probably not going to happen.
Of the insurance adjustment, the $34,000?
Yeah, the reduction. Okay.
So the reality is we also have another, you know, we could raise these inspection fees if we had to, because that's what inspection fees are based on. So we do have a different way to recoup it. But I think anyone that's been on the job market now, I'm not hiring at the entry rate. I'm hiring at almost the rate of somebody who's leaving after long tenures. And it's insulting to the incumbent that's left, but that's the market. And at some point, we have our... We do have a fiduciary responsibility to do our tasks, and if we can't find anyone, we can't do it.
We've got minimum mandated services that were challenged in the meeting.
Struggle.
Can
I need a motion?
Okay.
I will move to authorize the Director of Health to reclassify the position as needed and appropriate in an effort to fill the current full-time environmental health field staff vacancy.
Second.
Let's move to the second. Further discussion? And I think
this
so.
Is Ryan.
Go ahead.
I would just echo some of what John was just saying. I mean, anybody who works in a management position now, municipal or otherwise, knows that this is very much a job seeker's market. Knows how hard it is right now for employers to recruit top talent. And I'm not entirely surprised that we're losing somebody after 8 months over potentially some wage issues. So while I certainly can understand aversion to this and raising potentially raising the wage in this case substantially, I think this is the reality that we live in, and I would support the motion.
Thank you.
Can I have that? I have faith in our health director in finding the adequate individual, and not certainly not just looking at the top of range of our salary in order to fill it, but doing it responsibly.
I'll echo that and just add one other comment, that we can train somebody, and unless the market changes within 8 months to a year and a half, we'll train somebody that will leave.
This position has had has turned over twice in the past 2 years. So it's turned over each year.
So until the market forces change, being a training ground, you can afford when you're a certain size agency, the smaller you get, the less you can afford to do that. So
my follow-on question to that is that what are we doing to ensure we're not getting poached by other municipalities? I ask myself that question all the time, and the answer is nothing, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, so we're a small house. You know, I know my staff pretty well. And many of them have been with us for many years, and I don't know how the other managers around the room think about this, but whenever I see a job posting, I always think, okay, who could be interested in that, and why? Every time I see a posting, I'm always thinking, who could be interested in why, and then is there anything I can do about it? Mm-hmm. And so that I'm always considering those factors, again, particularly you have to in today's market. Workforce development's a big issue right now in many industries, and public health is no different. My colleagues at CADH and at CEHA are working to try to improve workforce development, because there's definitely a deficit of qualified sanitarians out there. to a certain degree, I feel like we all have a certain responsibility to support workforce development, and if we can train somebody as part of our effort, that'd be great. If I thought they were going to stick around for 2 years or more, I'd be more comfortable with that. But we've done it twice now, mm-hmm. and both times they bolted. And so as John said, we're a very small entity. It's hard to sustain that. So, but workforce development is a priority for my office and this industry, and figuring out how to keep the good qualified staff we have is also a priority.
I don't know what you're actually doing, so this may be preaching to the choir, but you know, if you have somebody where you're conditioning certain things on certification, mm-hmm. you know, once you transition to technically yep. being a sanitarian mm-hmm. one,
right.
essentially, you automatically move into that classification.
Yep. Okay. That is, I mean, it depends on the person, depends on the position, but that is a tactic I have used in the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Rob, do we do exit interviews?
We do. The Town of Mansfield Human Resources Department does exit interviews for us, and they did one for the last couple of candidates. And I have, as far as I know, they went okay. They're confidential interviews, so I presume they'd tell me if there was a problem.
Ready to vote on this?
Yeah, we need to vote. Is the discussion done? Anything else? All right, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any abstentions or votes to the negative? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to CGS Section 19A, 36I, Itinerant Mobile Food Vendor Reciprocal Licensing Memorandum of
So you have in your packet a cover letter and a copy of a draft memorandum of agreement. Connecticut General Statute mandated that local public health or state public health working with local public health develop a process which would provide for reciprocity for food trucks and food trailers. Obviously, this is an effort to make it easier again for the small business community to be able to move around and operate freely in multiple jurisdictions without having to go through the local regulatory process. I've attached the MOU. The primary terms and conditions are that this MOU would not apply to multi-day events such as harvest fairs. The local health department who participates in this MOU or MOA cannot charge fees of any type for visiting mobile vendors. If we participate, we must manage and update a DPH web-based system for updating information on these vendors. This does not apply to vendors that do tents or other kind of temporary setups. It's only self-contained trucks or self-contained trailers. There's no deadline upon which we would have to execute this MOA, and it's an optional MOA. However, that being said, the state health officials have implied, you know, and actually come out and said it, that if they can't get a critical mass of local health departments signing onto this MOA, then the Connecticut General Assembly may mandate it anyway, because that's where this is going. That being said, as it currently stands, if we execute this MOA, it would help 9 local mobile food vendors. We currently license annually 9 mobile food trucks. It could also affect up to 12 temporary events in which food trucks attend around the health district, which involve around 36 visiting trucks from other jurisdictions. I project at this point in time, based on how this MOA language is interpreted, there's still some uncertainty associated with that, there would be a revenue loss, annual revenue loss of from about $1,500 to $2,800, depending. Really, it's really depending on whether or not the food trucks which go to the farmers markets are applicable or not. And that's still uncertain, despite my questions to that effect to state health officials. So we're still working that piece out. If we were to participate, it would take about 50 man hours to start the whole process up, you know, because we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to update a number of forms that we have online and otherwise to match what the state wants to do with this and to train staff on the web-based system and to develop our own internal protocols on how to manage it.
You also need a list, don't you? All the vendors who are...
That would be on the web-based system.
Is it there already?
It has been developed, but information hasn't been uploaded yet because the state initiative doesn't technically start until July 1st. At least that's their objective. They haven't finalized that date, as far as I know.
And the person probably doing it just retired.
Yeah. Yeah. So right now, while the total man hours may seem minimal, and is supportive of small business owners. The problem for us right now is that, you know, we're already really busy this summer and fall with the startup of the cosmetology program. We've got some other initiatives that we're working on. There's a possibility that that we might have to start thinking about issues with lead too, which is another mandate that's come down the pipe.
PFAS.
Yep. The other mandate that's coming down the pipe that we have to deal with in the next 6 months or so is related to childhood mental health, and that's a topic later on in the discussion, which is a bill that was just recently passed, Public Act 2146, in which we're obligated to get staff trained and then do training. So we got a lot going on right now. So I'm recommending, while I think this is not an unreasonable approach and is certainly worth considering, that for now anyway, we defer it until sometime next winter, so we can get some of these other things moving first, like the cosmetology, the mental health bill, and start to wrap our heads around how lead may be affecting us.
So this cooperation has to be statewide. You couldn't say within our health district.
So the way the MOA works is that every local health department which signs on is now part of the jurisdiction in which local vendors can move from one area to the other without having to apply for local.
But right now, for our food vendors, mm-hmm. they get one from the health district, and as long as they stay within the health district towns, they're covered by one.
That's correct.
So by but being
aren't they inspected by a health district? Somewhere?
Under this proposal, they would have to be inspected by their home district?
So under this proposal, if we signed it and we had a food truck visiting us to attend an event or go to a roadside.
Farmer's market.
We could not require them to apply for a temporary food permit.
Would we inspect it?
But I would think we would have a professional obligation to still inspect them. We still have my local health obligation to protect the health and welfare of our local population doesn't cease. You know, if we get an event like, for example, say the Coventry Fest has four food trucks, they're all from out of town. They all come from health districts or health departments that are signatories of this agreement along with us. The notion of us not inspecting those food trucks poses a risk to the population of the town of Coventry. So,
but it doesn't say if they have a home base authorization, you can still inspect them. They just don't have to license it.
Well, we still can. We still may inspect them. Our inspection is optional. We don't have to do it pursuant to this. But I'm telling you, we probably still would.
Okay, so why wouldn't we jump on this as a way to help you? I see it as a win-win.
It's just going to take time to get the staff trained and. If we try to start it up now with the other initiatives we're doing with.
What are we starting up? I'm not getting it.
So we have to participate with the web-based system that the state has set up. Okay, so we have to upload the information on all our local vendors. We have to update our forms to match the state's forms. We have to train the staff on how to use the web-based system. It takes staff time to do all that. And I'm just asking for a delay until February to get all this other stuff going before we execute this.
But your recommendation is that
is there anything negative to a delay? I mean, does that mean
negative? Is there a negative to the delay?
The negative to the delay is that it adds to the already burdensome workload that my staff have.
The negative to the delay is that
you'll have another legislative session where they may just implement this unilaterally, and we have no control over it.
But I think Rob's recommendation is that we defer this no later than February of 23, so before that legislation is done, and I think that gives you time to prepare when and if we say yes to go boots on the ground.
How did these itinerant vendors become so politically powerful?
I don't know. there's those legislators that are part of the work group that put this together that are pushing this through. I'm not sure which ones it is.
They've got a lobby, though.
Wasn't me.
I think it's a reasonable idea. I'm not opposed to it in any way. We just need time to implement. That's all.
And if I think about it, if I was a food vendor, the last thing I'd want to do, I'd want to be able to get one application by my local health district and go wherever I could get in and make some money.
You go to the crappiest health district with no inspections, and that's where you go.
Well, pursuant to the MOA, they have to apply for their permit where their vehicle is registered. Mm-hmm.
The town.
Yep.
So they'll all be new here.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing I think of the negative would be the fact that if we're not participating, people may avoid our Coventry sites or Wilmington sites just because we don't have it. We're not part of the agreement.
They're not going to give up that. Right. Yeah. I mean, the loss of revenue was $2,800.
Yeah. I don't think it's the permit fee. I think it's the nuisance. It's going to get another permit and going to get inspected.
So how do we ensure that somebody who shows up, because I mean theoretically if somebody has that, how do we even know that they're going
right
to an event?
Right, that's a good question. Well, it's not in the MOA, actually I don't think it's in the MOA, but it is in the frequently asked questions, and in the cover letter it says do you have to notify the health department ahead of time? If your local health department and the department you're going to jurisdiction is a signature in the MOA, do you have to notify them ahead of time? The FAQ says yes, you have to notify them ahead of time. But I don't think that it's expressly stated in the MOA itself. I think that they're just going to push that as part of the implementation guidance.
Because for us, when we issue a permit, do we issue a location to?
No, but we do. But usually the truck is also licensed along with a base of operations, which is usually a commercial grade kitchen, which has a brick and mortar location, and so that's part of the licensing.
Like if you take Lizzie for an example,
yeah, exactly.
Why would she want to go to a health district that doesn't participate? And likewise, why does somebody from New Haven want to come here if we don't participate?
It's again, the fee is not that much.
No, I don't think it's the fee. I think it's the nuisance, as you said.
But you go to where your customer, where you have potential customers. That's why you go there, and that's why we bring in people. Our opening day of the farmers market, we had 5,000 people there. 5,000.
And that's a lot. I think the event will draw them in, and we're talking about potentially one
season
in our health district.
Yeah.
So that's really too late for this year anyway, because I didn't even have the things set up.
I think it's crazy to move forward with it, but if we can plan for. I think people will come to some of our larger events.
I'd just like to state, I think going all the way, that we're in favor of this, but
yeah,
we understand your position, and don't forget to bring it back.
Absolutely.
Okay. Because we'll hound you.
What happens if we approve it with an implementation date of...
Well, you can... I mean, you could authorize me to sign it now, or actually...
Well, by signing it, had you...
But I can't, but we could...
I don't think it's really ready yet to sign it.
But if we sign it, you have to implement it.
You could authorize me to sign it at some date down the road, now, if you wanted to.
You would like to sign it December 31st?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're basically in agreement with it, I would rather just say, look, we're all in agreement with this. We recognize there are some difficulties with immediate implementation. Mm-hmm. Let's set a goal of December 31st having this agreement in place.
Yeah, some if you want to pass,
I agree.
Pass a motion to have it. That way everybody's on the record as supporting it. Mm-hmm. And then I can report that to the State Health Department, and they'll be happy about that.
We're going to defer a couple of months.
We're just going to give it some time.
So is there a motion?
If I may suggest, I'm asking for February 2023.
Okay,
yeah.
I think it was in there, the motion.
Well, it's a recommendation for deferring.
But we can...
So.
There's a motion down here somewhere.
Well, there's not actually a motion.
Can I move that we execute the MOU?
Authorize
the Director of Health to execute the MOU for, on the fly and on the phone, CSG Section 19A-36I, insured mobile food vendor, reciprocal licensing MOA. No later than February 2023.
No later means you could sign it tomorrow.
Okay.
So,
right. But he's not going
about,
to.
On or about.
February
28th,
2023.
Okay.
Give you the whole month.
So
I'll second that motion.
We moved and seconded. People understand the motion? Further discussion on the motion? So we're in agreement that we're going to do this in the future on or about February 28th. And Rob can tell people that you're authorized to sign it coming up.
Yep.
February 2023.
Yep. Millie, tell Dr. Dardick, yeah, I'm going to ask him about monkeypox.
Okay. So I think he had to go soon. So we should, if you don't mind, let's take a vote on this. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Yeah, aye. Opposed or...
Oops. That was supposed to go to Dr. Dardick.
Abstentions? Hearing none? Motion carries. And I think, if you don't mind, we're going to move to Dr. Dardick's report. So, Dr. Dardick, do you have some information for us to share?
No, well, I didn't have anything prepared. I was wondering whether Rob had anything wanted to speak about specifically.
Yeah, I do. I wanted to maybe talk about monkeypox a little bit.
Okay.
Just, John, you know, an overview of your perspective on this issue. And,
got it.
And
Wasan.
I'm what? Sorry, and what else?
Wasan? Isn't that the other?
Powassan.
Powassan.
Powassan. Yeah, Powassan and monkeypox.
Okay. All right, fine. So, first of all, I understand that there are some meetings at Washington. Either today or tomorrow, and they're actually considering changing the name of monkeypox because it really has nothing to do with monkeys, and it's an unfortunate name. The very, very, very first time it was ever isolated, it was found in a monkey, and that's how it got the name. But it's a first cousin of smallpox, and it predominantly has skin manifestations. It's a so-called pox virus, and up until now, there have been cases every year in various parts of Central and West Africa, usually related to people who may have had contact with small rodents, they think. They actually think that the reservoir nature is in mice and rats. And so there have been a few cases here and there, pretty much predictably every year. Cases from West Africa tend to be much more dangerous, and occasionally people die. Cases from Central Africa tend to be much milder, more like a chickenpox type presentation, and people get better. And the numbers of cases are 20, 50, or hundreds per year. There are also very rare cases of importation into Europe and the United States. But now, recently, something has changed. And what has changed is that there have been hundreds, I mean, the last count I saw was 700 or 800 cases worldwide, maybe up over 1,000 at this point. And the connection seems to have something to do with close physical contact between people. It's been found in large numbers of men who have sex with men. It's not sexually transmitted in the sense of a traditional sexually transmitted infection, but it appears to be the close body contact of one person to another. So it's intimate contact rather than sexual contact. It does not appear to be airborne, although, you know, we're still, it's sort of like where we were 2 years ago with coronavirus. We're still on the steep learning curve with monkeypox. Almost all of the cases that have been identified in Europe and in the US are similar to the Central African strain of this virus, which means that although people have been sick, there have been effectively no deaths from it. And so people break out in a rash, they have a fever, they get a little sick, and then eventually it resolves. Because it's a first cousin of smallpox, people who are old enough to have had smallpox vaccinations when they were kids, and that's mostly people who are, let's say, 60 years and older, seem to have some protection against this monkeypox virus. So it's mostly occurring in younger people. In addition, smallpox vaccine does appear to help protect against monkeypox infection. And so there are tens of millions of doses of smallpox vaccine around the world, which could be used if it ever became appropriate. Right now, that does not appear to be something that's necessary for the general population. When there have been cases of this monkeypox in a hospital setting, I believe they have vaccinated some of the healthcare workers or people who've been in close contact with the cases. And Rob, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think Connecticut has had a case yet.
Not yet, but we have received right. We have received guidance from the state health department what to do if we do get a case,
right.
Which involves.
Right. But anyway, so far it hasn't hit here, but it could very well. In addition, there's another vaccine, which is called Jynneos, Jynneos, which I first heard about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, which is a brand new recombinant type vaccine. Designed for smallpox, but it's a different formulation than the traditional smallpox vaccine and has some advantages. Anyway, there's something like 100 million doses of Jynneos stockpiled here in the U.S., mostly for military, but they could be used. So the point is, if it turns out that this virus does start to spread on a community basis, it appears that there's plenty of vaccine which would be available right off the bat. They don't have to first invent the vaccine and make it. They just have to distribute. But at the moment, there doesn't appear to be a need for it because it's only being seen in individuals who have close contact with someone else who's had it. But as you've seen in the news accounts from what started out a few weeks ago, one case here, 7 cases in Belgium, we're now up to, as I said, 700 or higher worldwide. So it's scary because it's new. It's scary because it's related to smallpox. Smallpox is airborne, and very highly contagious. This virus does not appear to be airborne, but again, we're still learning. So, first of all, any questions about what is currently known as monkeypox, but maybe you know something different next week?
Is that synonymous with what used to be called like cowpox or the Moroccan pox?
No, I mean cowpox or vaccinia is the virus from which the smallpox vaccine is made.
Okay.
Okay, so Powassan virus. Powassan virus is carried by the same tick that carries Lyme disease. It's very rare, but there are cases. For example, just last month, there was a case in Windham, and just a few weeks ago, there was, I believe, a fatal case out in London. I also read there was a case up in the state of Maine. And every year, in fact, in our office, one of our patients had Powassan, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. It's a scary virus because it can be transmitted within the first 10 or 15 minutes of a tick bite. Mm-hmm. Unlike Lyme, where we think the tick has to be attached for a day or two to transmit Lyme disease, Powassan can be transmitted very, very quickly, even if you remove the tick right away. There's no treatment for Powassan virus. It's related to West Nile. It's actually also related to yellow fever. It's what's called a flavivirus. And it affects the brain. So it can produce an encephalitis or a brain fever. And people who get Powassan can be very sick. I think the statistics are that something like 50% of people who have Powassan have long-term consequences from their virus. They don't ever make an entirely full recovery. And there are also fatalities. So it could be a dangerous virus. But the good news is it's very rare. And although we just had 2 cases, which kind of gets people ramped up, there's no reason to think that there's any more Powassan virus now than there has been in the last 5 to 10 years. So protection against tick bite would be key. Questions?
All right. Thanks,
thank
Dr. Doherty.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sorry, I've got to go.
All right. Thank you. So I guess we're up to town reports. And we're going to have to start speeding up, I guess. I was talking to myself, I know. who wants to go first?
I'll start. I'll be brief. We finally signed a contract after going back to the AG's office with DPH for our STEEP grant, which will put a septic system at our old town hall. So I'm excited to be able to move forward on that. It's been a long time coming. And I feel a little guilty, but happy to say our budget passed on the first vote.
Oh, rub it in. Yeah.
Health-wise.
So we're moving ahead with a whole series of different projects. We're making quite a bit of progress on our connectivity grant project, which has been nice to see. Had a couple minor snafus. Like everybody else, a lot of our RFPs are coming back incredibly high, which is daunting. But we do have a budget, which is good, and we're just moving along.
Mark, you want to go?
Sure. We had a great meeting in Andover the other night, Tuesday night, on the Hop River Trail. Thank you, Eric, for coordinating that. We had a really good turnout for a multiple town and state effort to help brainstorm with how to make the Hop River Trail a gold standard of something all our towns are proud of. Besides just the airline trail, we want the Hop River Trail to really be an economic driver. So that meeting was super, and our town budget passed with 36 positive votes and no negative votes. Sorry, John.
Tell me now.
Tammy?
Well, we have, I think we finally got the majority of our permitting stuff for our Santini apartment buildings. About 240 units are going to be built behind Big Y, so that's going to be a big one coming. That is on the septic, though, and the septic and public water line, so no sanitary yet. No septic's there. It's on the septic line. We don't need the
sewer.
The,
it's on the sewer.
Right.
So it's on the sewer line. That's what I meant to say. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. We have RFPs out for our fire stations, and we saw what was supposed to be $2 million climb to $5 million through our RFP process. It's actually $4.8 million. I'm an accountant, so I'm rounding it to five. So it's very discouraging what we're seeing from that kind of build and that, but we'll be looking to move forward with those. And I believe, well, we're putting them back on existing land, so I don't think there's going to be much of an issue there with connectivity or anything, but that's about it.
How about a manager?
Well, we hired a manager. He starts on the 27th. The new manager is going to be Brian Foley.
Brian Foley?
Foley.
Brian
Foley.
Where is he from?
He's actually a common citizen. He lived there his whole life. He is the ex-deputy chief of Hartford Police Department. Also worked for the state under the, really worked there much longer, but underneath the commissioner for the state police. Had a lot of experience up at the state capitol and such, so he'll be starting, I believe, on the 27th.
Great.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I just have a couple things, and maybe Deb will have something too. But we had our first beach closer at Patriots Park. We'll see how the retest goes. The local place where Daisy's Creamery is trying to finally, after 2 years of living there, but not running a restaurant, is seeking permits now for a restaurant called Burger Pies and Fries. They need to get us a letter from the landlord saying that they can make the changes that are required.
This is the old Reed's place?
The old Reed's.
I like that. Burgers, pies, and fries.
Yeah. They're from, I think, North Brantford restaurant. Forgetting the name of it, but it was had pretty good menu, mostly a breakfast lunch place. But
breakfast? Did you say breakfast?
Yes.
For burgers and pies, you know, let's go.
Again, knows there's some conflict going on with their landlord. So, we'll see how that all goes. But they have to, while it's been a restaurant, they're making some changes, and they get to have the landlord approve some of those, especially since they're have what was an office. That they want to turn into apartments, so there's fire separation issues and so forth, but they finally hired an architect to deal with it, and it may not be as bad as they thought. So we'll see, but I also wanted to mention our library is actually going to start. That came in over budget, but the library is able to kick in some money from their funds. Our transfer station came in. We had expected $500,000, it's $780,000. So prices are just through the roof, just absolutely through the roof. And some of it's diesel fuel, some of it's supply. One of our intersection project, we're basically done with the paving, and we're waiting until sometime in October to get the light poles, traffic signal poles. So whether that'll be finished this year or not, who knows? But we're starting another project that came in only $100,000 over on South Street. I don't know how we're going to survive this inflation. I just don't know how. And our budget in the past, council did go down to a zero mill rate and have a budget meeting on Monday and vote the following Tuesday, the 28th. So we'll see. Do you have anything else to
put in there? The library is the only night.
Yeah.
Can I have one more?
Yeah.
I forgot to mention a new restaurant, Breakfast.
Yes.
In Wellington, the old River and Rail.
Yes.
Of the flat, I want to make sure I get it right, Flat Penny Kitchen. I know they had hoped to open this weekend when I met with the new owner at the town hall. She didn't think that was going to happen for obvious setback reasons that everybody has. but it will be open for breakfast and lunch daily, and Thursday through Sunday for dinner. So,
thank you.
I'm looking forward to having a breakfast place. I miss it.
Yes.
Yeah, Ryan, are you still on the call? Anything from Mansfield?
I am. One second. I just started another meeting, and I'm making dinner. I'm trying to not burn the house down because I have 3 kids in the house.
Multitasking.
Are the horses fed?
No, my wife's going to feed the horses when she gets home. So I got 2 Zoom meetings built, dinner going, and I got hopefully all 3 kids in the house somewhere. So, anyway, in Mansfield, things are going well. We have got our budget adopted back on May 10th, almost unanimously, so that was great. The council is taking its way through full final adoption of the American Rescue Plan funding, utilization of the funding as recommended by staff. Recent installments include $370,000 for a local business assistance program for businesses that have been negatively impacted by the pandemic, a few $100,000 for direct financial assistance to individuals who also impacted by the pandemic and are facing things like eviction or foreclosure or way behind on their utility bills, a number of infrastructure projects that have rescue plan funding as match. We received a $4.8 million grant, Connecticut Communities Challenge grant from Department of Economic and Community Development. That'll be for a combination of transportation improvements on South Eagleville Road and pedestrian safety improvements, as well as funding towards the planned Eagleville Green housing development, which will have a large affordable housing component. So. Otherwise, we unfortunately weren't successful this go around with a project that we have been trying to get funded. Congressman Courtney's office has been very helpful, but this is a sidewalk, sorry, a multi-use trail on 195 that would connect downtown stores to the Four Corners area. We think it's really, really, really important from a public safety standpoint because, especially as more development takes place in the Four Corners, you're going to have more people walking in the road as opposed to on a safe trail or sidewalk. And so I think those are some of the highlights. It's always a pleasure to see Rob on a daily basis in the halls. You know, he's got a smile on his face. He's a pretty good guy. So.
Thanks, Ryan.
I should have mentioned Congressman Courtney did give us and it's forwarded to the Appropriation Committee for further consideration. $1.5 million for sewer connection into Holton.
Great.
Super. So if not a done deal, it's got to go through appropriations and then to the consolidation budget of the Senate. So, but we're starting to work on getting all the other agreements that have gone on.
Now. Susan Powers?
Susan?
She had to leave.
She's gone,
okay. So moving on then. I guess we're up to Finance Committee financial reports.
Yes, in your packet you do have the financial report for the period ending March 31, 2022. I'm going to just kind of quickly run through the highlights on the first table. Third column from the right, titled 2022. Highlights in this column under the revenue side, I just want to note that our fee-for-service revenue streams are doing reasonably well. You know, the septic side of things, septic permits and soil testing and septic plan reviews are all ahead of where we would project we want to be for the budget for 75% of the budget period. Whereas we're kind of behind on B100As, but I think in the end we're gonna probably fall pretty close to the budget amount of revenues for those service fee categories.
Have we reminded the towns that haven't paid?
You recall that we cut the rate for this current fiscal year, which is why it's below what we would anticipate. So that's a subtotal for total revenues as of this period is $801,241, or 88% of the adopted budget. Moving on down to expenditures, we're ahead on grant deductions because of, mostly because of COVID funding that we're continuing to get, and so I'm anticipating that that'll be above. We're also behind, or also below on salaries again because of vacancies that we're gonna be experiencing. And then the other expenditure line I want to bring to your attention is professional technical. That's above where we anticipate this time of year, and that's predominantly because we didn't have enough qualified staff to do a restaurant inspection, so we had to hire a subcontractor to backfill that. And we'll have to continue that again moving forward now with this recent resignation in that environmental health position. And so that subtotal for total expenditures is $637,406. Or 70% of the adopted budget, which gives us an operating surplus for this period of $163,836. That number is going to go down as the fiscal year progresses because the state grant of $208,000 got paid all at once near the beginning. But I think we're looking pretty good this time. Based on these numbers at this time of the fiscal year. I'd be glad to answer any questions anybody may have. And it'd be appropriate for a motion to accept the report too at some point.
Is there a motion to accept the financial report?
So moved.
Moved by Deb Walsh.
Second.
Seconded by Erica. I think she just beat it.
Good.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any abstentions or negatives? Hearing none, so carried. Executive committee auditor appointment.
This is just a report out.
Yeah.
Okay. Just a report out.
Yes, we did this.
Okay. Yep. So this is just, you have a copy of the minutes. The board executive committee, due to a time sensitive issue, met to formally appoint Clifton Larson and Allen LLP as the auditing firm for fiscal year 21-22 based on a recommendation from the finance department. And so this is just a report out unless anybody has any questions.
So for people that aren't keeping up with auditors, that's the former Bloom Shapiro.
Oh, thank you, because I'm going to say it's a different one than we've had before.
They got bought out, and they're different.
Okay.
Okay, we can move on to director's reports.
Yeah, so for the first item under director's report, you'll recall at the last board meeting, and I had basically informed the board of an impending report. The health district, by way of background, and some of you are already aware of this, members of the board, the health district's been collecting and compiling water quality data from private wells for the past 6 years or so, really since June 2016. On sodium and chloride exceedances. This program was initiated because environmental health staff at that time had noticed an uptick in the number of sodium chloride detections, and so we felt it appropriate to start collecting data on the issue. And so we've been collecting water test results for private wells. If either the sodium recommended standard of 100 milligrams per liter or the chloride maximum contaminant level of 250 milligrams per liter is exceeded. To date, we've compiled a list of 145 private wells with either sodium and or chloride exceedance. Of those 145, 78 are within the town of Tallinn, 25 in Bolton, 22 in Coventry, 14 in Mansfield, 2 in Ashford, 2 in Andover, and 2 in Willington, and there are maps. There's a geographic map in there, and there's also just a graph showing the numbers that I just pointed out too. A couple of things I want to point out with this information as it's been put forth. This information definitely essentially supports sodium chloride as an emerging contaminant concern amongst private water supply wells in Connecticut. I mean, the primary purpose of this report and this information is to provide situational awareness to all the stakeholders in this agency and on the board, and contribute to the Connecticut information that's out, that's already out there on the matter. The health department is not offering any conclusions or strictly speculating on the cause or sources of contamination of any single one of these locations. There are many potential sources of sodium chloride, as many of us understand. Kind of the two primary sources are kind of residential water softening discharges and road salting and de-icing activities. There are a number of limitations to this survey. The individual properties are not for public distribution. It, you know, my reading of the Connecticut General Statutes is that since this is potentially health-related information, that it's confidential. And so we're reporting out only aggregate information at this time with non-specific locations. The attached map is very broad and general. If individual towns want kind of more information on what roads were impacted, we could, the health district can accommodate that. We can look at kind of individual road areas.
Can we like tie it up to our snow plow routes to see what drivers are doing bad things?
That's what I was gonna say.
Well, so we don't know that it's road salt per se. I mean, there have been instances in which it's, in which water softening devices and home treatment discharges are clearly a material contributor,
right,
to some of these issues. So it's, I think it's important not to immediately draw any conclusions.
However, when you see a nice linear line down going down, yeah, a certain roadway,
yeah,
contributing, yeah, factors.
So the other limitation to this is we have no baseline. We just started collecting this information, and so it's just nothing more than aggregate counts over the course of the year. I think it does provide some perspective. Kind of the next steps. Some of the stuff.
Before you get off the map,
sure.
Is there anything significant with the fact that you have a concentration of little houses around the lake area?
I would say not.
Okay.
You know, I mean, again, these
got a
are
a lot of roads, a lot of hills.
A lot of roads, a lot of hills. Shallow bedrock is also an issue in some of these locations where cluster housing. There's not a whole lot of overburdened soil, so any contamination sources, whether it's water softeners or road salt, can infiltrate the bedrock aquifer very quickly.
Is there a correlation with how hilly the area is?
You know,
that would be my primary.
Yeah, and all of those are potential factors, and the reality is groundwater hydrology is a really complicated issue, and it's really hard to speculate in general terms.
And I will tell you that citizens want immediate response, and when they go to DEP and you're starting to deal with DEP, before you even go over to the DOH side, it's years. It's like years, and they expect immediate things. It's like, it's years.
Yeah.
Well, let's be honest. There are some people, I've got residents that have had contaminated water for the last 7 years, and they can't sell their homes, they can't drink their water. You know, it's this is not trivial. This is like,
I'm not saying
people
that
without potable drinking water. So, you know, it's hard because there's contributing factors. It's nobody wants to take responsibility for this. Nobody does.
Yeah.
It's not an easy problem. And the challenge is that this is not a contamination you can just easily treat like many other contaminants.
Oh,
you can't install a treatment system to solve this problem that doesn't cost tens of thousands of dollars,
wow,
and discharge hundreds of gallons a day of regulated wastewater. And, you know, all house reverse osmosis system is not a practical solution, unfortunately.
You have to drill a new well?
Even that's not.
If your aquifer is contaminated.
Water's contaminated at the source.
Yeah.
So, it's not even a new well.
So you start looking at water line extensions if there's anything nearby, and that could be millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Or you look at community wells, which are not easy to get permitted. But you still have to have an adequate water source.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We have one neighborhood in town that DEP we have reporting on, and that and it's going to cost $15 million to bring water to that neighborhood.
That was
pre like all this crazy. That was about 6 months ago, so God knows what it is now.
So I don't know. I mean, generally, it's my understanding that sodium is considered an emerging groundwater contaminant. Mm-hmm. Chloride's been around for a little while, mm-hmm. and so may fall under some of the infrastructure funding bill that went out there under the drinking water system and public water system.
They're really looking at lead.
Well, they're looking at PFAS now too.
Yeah,
but sodium may be a potential angle there. Anyway.
Well, you know how Holland does. We've applied for the grant. I've been working with Courtney's office and the Capitol to try to get funding for this. And it's, I'll let you know how Holland does.
Yeah, okay.
And I've got an application pending before the drinking water fund. Working with Connecticut Water to extend, you know, but it's kind of still a million and a half for five houses.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Buy the houses, tear them down.
Right, yeah. I'll trade
you. Yeah, I mean, we're just, based on these dots, we're just at the start of this. Because we solved one, we got one to go away with some curving, but we got a neighborhood.
So the health district will continue to, you know, update our database, work with, you know, educating property owners and continue to provide, you know, our consultation preliminary assessment services. We're obligated to make, you know, referrals to DEP when appropriate. There was a bill that came out. I don't know if it was formally passed, but it's SB 240, an act concerning sodium chloride mitigation, snow and ice accumulations. It mandates a salt applicator training program, which DEEP and DOT, working with UConn, is to develop, and obligates salt applicators to register, which both public and private, having gone through the program, requires health departments to report annually any detections and exceeds to OPM, so that OPM can find money for these people. So I don't know if this bill was formally I have not been able to find out whether it was formally approved or not, but as far as I can tell on the website, it looks like it passed everything. So, and we may be hearing more about this.
Is that?
It is SB 240.
You can go online and look.
Yeah, well, I did. It's all black. It all looks like it's, but I don't know if the governor signed it or anything.
Governor has only vetoed one bill.
Yeah.
No, he vetoed two.
Two? Okay. One was really good veto.
Yeah, it was a really, really good veto.
We worked hard on it.
Really bad bill.
It was a really bad
bill. A really bad bill.
And so, you know, Health District will continue to support the towns with the individual sites. One thing that we are going to do is we're going to start reaching out and working with the residential water treatment industry to try to get them on board with educating their customers.
How about installing them legitimately?
Well, so legitimately, also that too, because
we have a lot that have not installed any other septic-like system. They
so
just dump it.
Yeah, we'll be working with industry to try to improve their professionalism and their ability to educate their clients. And one thing this has already done is it definitely affects the decision making of this office when somebody proposes where they're going to drill a well. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to keep them away from roads now. You know, highly roads with high volume, and also locations where on-site wastewater discharge subsurface systems, which are dedicated to water softeners, go. We also take a closer look at those now as a result of this. So we'll continue to work on this issue as best we can. It's not an easy one. But I'm going to be sharing this information with Deep in the near future.
Go ahead, Tammy.
240 didn't get voted on.
It didn't get voted on. Okay.
It died on the calendar.
Interesting.
But I can tell you, next session, I guarantee you're going to see more. We had, I think, combined, me and a couple of legislators, had at least 3 bills on contaminants, on the sodium contaminants, so.
Okay. Thank you, Tammy.
So there are some alternative de-icing products that are coming out that could reduce the amount of sodium, more naturally based. Obviously, people can go back to sand, but sand was kind of pushed out by DEP as a water pollutant for small stream-like creatures that I can't remember the name of them. But so salt is not, sand is not good. People are, you know, to talk about just go back to sand. It's first off, not a de-icing, it's traction only, but it also pollutes the streams.
It creates turbidity and erosion problems in the streams.
Right.
So what new products do you know of that you said were coming?
I can send it to you. It's a natural based. It's almost like a wood chip product that you mix with so you can cut the amount of down by like 25%, and it's supposed to give you the. So we'll see. You know, I want to try it because it's not that expensive to just try it like on one root to see how it does.
Yeah.
And maybe something. That, I mean, we got to start experimenting with something. We had used a Budweiser beer byproduct. Called Ice Band Magic, and it actually was really good until it got 50 degrees and it turned into slickness. We had to sand the ice proofing, but it was really good. So I think there will come something that will provide some safety that will be better than the product we have right now. But a lot of it is that our users just put too much down, and the idea or concept of a black road in the winter has to be, we have to get away from that.
But that's customer expectation,
right? Yeah, we have to lower those expectations,
right?
I'll tell you though, Tallinn went through that green snow program, whatever it was, the Yukon's green snow and we're seeing more and more people coming over with us contaminated. So, we even went through that entire program. We were early going through that program.
Yeah, and we're all through that too. It's just a matter of, the drivers can be good, but sometimes they just turn it up a little bit.
Going up a hill, they're going to hit the hot button and, you know, salt the heck out of it because they know that's where the accidents are going to be, and that's where we get in trouble.
So the education is a part of it, but I think the reality is that there's going to have to be some alternative means and change of expectations. I mean, just you can't drive 60 when it's snowy out.
So in the areas up around Montreal, at least a couple of winters ago when I was up there, they were using it's basically a salty mulch.
That's where this other product is kind of looking at.
Yeah, it's super muddy in the spring, but you know what they say the advantage of it is it will decompose, so you don't actually have to do anything. Like there's no roadside sweeping or anything. It's light enough that it blows off the roadway, then it will decompose on the shoulders. But it is apparently pretty muddy.
So the state legislature should fund some demo projects for some of these products.
I put forward legislation that said I wanted an environmentally friendly way to treat the roads within 3 years, and I couldn't get it past. I couldn't get it past the committees. I will keep trying. I've put it in twice now, and then.
Well, obviously,
the state needs to do something.
We need to use the type of support, and we need to get some of the other municipal lobbying people to get on board here.
You might want to look. My wife grew up in Pittsburgh. They threw down all the steel mill residue on the roads. Must have been like black ash or something, but that's how they treated all the roads the whole time she was growing up.
No heavy metals in that.
Yeah. Acid and heavy metals.
You know what? I think that's what they call black beauty when they're putting down a tack coat or something on the road. They sprinkle that over it so it doesn't transfer to cars.
That's why.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Rob. Keep us up to
I will.
On this.
Yep. Public. Just a kind of a heads up. Public Act 2146. This is a part of the campaign to address the mental health crisis among the youth in our population. It's certainly a significant problem. This particular public act mandates that local health departments get trained in question, persuade, refer, which is basically looking for warning signs of suicide crisis and how to respond. It was just kind of a surprise to local health when we saw this. It just popped up. Now we are responsible for getting staff trained on this particular topic in this particular curriculum. And then the mandate, as I read, is the director of health for each local health department shall determine the eligibility criteria for participation in the youth suicide prevention training program. So I'm required to get somebody trained and I'm required to develop eligibility criteria. What's interesting about this bill is it does not say I shall do the training, which is kind of weird.
So the person has to have 22 years experience to be qualified for the training?
No, they just have to go through a day of training. This particular training, QPR, Institute Gatekeeping Training, is one full day. So I'm sending somebody to the training, and we're going to do the training, and we're going to provide an opportunity for people to come. It's a train-the-trainer thing. So once we get the trainer trained, then we'll provide an opportunity for people who fall under the list of eligible individuals participating in this training. We will provide that training opportunity. So
Rob?
Yep?
I need to know how to get my social worker trained.
Once my person's trained to do the training, then we'll notify all the stakeholders that are on the list in this bill that when and where we're doing the training.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, activity report?
Yep.
I'm sorry, I skipped COVID.
Yep.
Nothing's happening with COVID, right?
Yeah, no. It's gone. Well, I want to talk about HB 5054, childhood lead poisoning. Okay. So this is kind of another mandate that's been adopted. It's right now, we have about 10 cases we currently manage of elevated blood lead levels. We manage them. Our public health nurses manages those, basically working with parents and providers to get the blood lead levels reduced. There's also a threshold in which we're obligated to go into the house and do an in-depth epidemiological investigation and environmental health inspection, which will result in an order to abate all environmental health lead sources on the property. It's the way it works. We have to maybe issue one order every 3 years. Each time we issue an order, it's very labor intensive. It takes anywhere from 40, 60 man hours to manage a single order and to manage that case. Now we're doing it, right now we're doing about once every 3 years. The way the standards are written now, by 2025, that number will probably go up to about 20 orders a year, and will be about another 1,000 man hours a year to be in compliance. Now don't get me wrong, this is important regulations. There's lots of kids out there getting poisoned, which it could be prevented, and the state has allocated monies to fund this program. Presumably some of it's gonna come to local public health. So there's still a lot to be worked out on this issue. So this is just a heads up on what's coming. And so there'll be more on this in the coming year. COVID responsibility. There's a couple of things I just wanna point out here in the activity update. Cases are going down, woo-hoo. Hopefully they'll stay down most of summer before they start going up again in the fall. I do want to point out that staff was very busy at the end of this school year in April and May, responding to clusters and outbreaks in schools. We had 12 clusters and outbreaks in 10 different schools we were supporting the response to. The other thing I wanted to just bring to your attention, is that we did receive the ELC2 grant for the contract just came to my office, final language, just a couple of days ago, for $378,850. I will be executing those documents in the coming days, and then be coming back to the board to ratify that. But so that money is coming. And then the other item on page 5, some new information. You'll see in the red lettering, second bullet, we detail that we've administered 174 doses to homebound residents, and you see a breakout of the number of residents in each town that we've been serving as homebound residents. So 4 in Andover, 15 in Ashford, 23 in Bolton, 4 in Chaplin, 34 in Columbia, 14 in Coventry, 29 in Mansfield, 6 in Scotland, 29 in Tallinn, and 16 in Wellington. That completes my COVID report, unless anybody has any questions.
Can I just a brief question that I don't know the answer to?
Sure.
Nothing about boosters moving forward for anything other than the current?
They just recently, FDA just recently approved boosters for pediatric doses from age 6 months to 4 years of age. We continue to provide weekly clinic hours on Mondays and Thursdays at the Mansfield Town Hall for both kids and adults. We will not be providing the doses to the really young ones from 6 months to 4. We just don't have the skill set for that. But we will be identifying providers in the area, making referrals as appropriate to families who make the inquiry. Also, we're doing as many pop-up clinics as we possibly can this summer at all of our festivals and fairs. So my nurses have been calling around to see who's willing to host a clinic. We're doing 2 or 3 at the farmer's market. We're doing one at Mansfield. And so if you've got an event you want us to go to for pop-up clinic, let us know.
The second booster for adults, something more.
So for those over 50 or have immunocompromised, they're eligible, but that we're still at that point. It hasn't expanded.
What was the time frame between the first booster and the second? 6 months?
6 months, I think, yeah.
Really?
You getting close?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, some people are saying stretch it out and wait till fall to get the booster so the booster is more effective. So there's another strategy.
Some of us just spent Mother's Day weekend with that in the nurse's office. That was my strategy.
So it might not be a good strategy, but there are people that are saying, why don't you wait till fall to get it, and then it may carry you more. But who knows?
If you've made it this far, give it a shot.
So that concludes my report, and unless anybody has any questions about communication.
I think I had it before this. Okay, any other questions for Rob? Communications, anything you need to highlight?
No. Dr. Barrett did that.
All right, so move to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Move to second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Rob. Sorry I'm letting this meeting run late.
Hopefully you'll get full agenda for the first time in a while.
I thought it was productive public hearing.
It was. It's
really good to have people provide input.
Absolutely. So thank you all. Thank you, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Everyone in my family, in-laws, my father-in-law's been in the hospital for 6 weeks now. It was COPD. So he was the only one who appeared asymptomatic. That should have been our first clue. The one with COPD is asymptomatic.
Hey, Dad, I'm just finishing a meeting.
And
I'll call you in a few minutes.
I said I wanted Mother's Day by myself without my children bothering me. That's not what I meant at all. Not even close.
I didn't feel good that February before, like the March 3rd.